But I've always been a bit of a thorn in my mum's side, you know.
Mm-hmm. Since you were little, or as you became?
No, I think when the trouble with the started and all that.
Did she know about that?
Yeah, she knows. Yeah.
Did she know at the time?
Well, you know, she had three other kids, and I said to her, you know, I had a problem with last night in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. I had a problem, and she said, oh, I don't think that's true. Yeah. Go to school. So I had to go to school, and I had to work it out myself, and I did. And I mean, I did. I don't know. Luckily he didn't start on me when I was really, really young. Like, this is when I was about 12, 13. I was already rebellious, and I was already like, don't fuck with me sort of thing. And I don't know where I got that from, but that's definitely in my blood or my genes or something. I worked out strategies to kick the shit out of him. So I'd work out strategies like, we had a bunk, a wooden bunk, just inside the door. So I'd brace myself on that bunk, and when he opened the door, I'd kick him in the guts, right? And then I'd be on him. So when I'm 14, I'm beating blokes up, and my mother's trying to pull me off him and everything, but I won. Kicked him down the stairs. Another time I pulled a knife on him, said, you come near me again. So there was a couple more times after that he was able to molest me, but I had this fire inside me, me belly, and I had this courage, you know, so I really, you know, had a way of being able to fight back.
Yeah.
But yeah, in another way, he really destroyed me. Mm. You know, he destroyed my young life and my thinking, and I went through many years of depression and you know, suicidal stuff, and ended up in a mental home a couple of times. And you know, I think if you do write a book about life, it's like you can get through anything.
Yep.
It's the way, you know, you can release yourself from that pain. And I was hopeless as a wife and probably as a mother too, in a lot of ways, you know. But the one thing I remember with my son is that I loved him with all my heart, you know. And so I think love conquers sort of everything. And I don't know, when you think about, you know, how you get through the world, I've no idea. But I do know that commitment to love for me is really important. I love these dogs, you know.
Yeah.
And I love what the dog did for me when I was a little girl, when I didn't have a mum around, because she put me in this room on my own, because you believe that's the way you bring joy. That dog was with me all the time, right? And so I was comforted and loved, and I was given the courage. Maybe I got the courage from a dog. You know, who knows? His name was Bob, and he was a big black retriever with that curly hair. And I remember him, but he was a great comfort to me. He was just always there, you know, under my cot. And if I was crying, he'd be up on the cot and licking my tears. And just, he was just a great, great companion, you know.
Yeah.
And he, like, the love that exudes a dog, you know, it's bigger than any parents can give you, really. You've got a really beautiful animal that loves you all, you know, its whole heart loves you, unconditional. Well, what do you need parents?
This is the Nitty Gritty Committee, conversations about the guts and the glory of life. And that is the voice of Linda Buller, originally of Melbourne, now of Ubud in Bali. Her life has swung through some pretty wild extremes. Now in her 60s, Linda's passionate nature shows no signs of letting her quietly retire, which is very good news for the homeless dogs of Bali. Anyone who's been to Bali knows the dogs we're talking about. They're everywhere, bless them. They're just, you know, weaving in and out of the millions of people and the motorbikes and the traffic, and they're looking for food and somewhere safe to just lie down and have a nap. For the last 16 years, Linda's been scooping them up, cleaning them up, vaccinating and dissexing them, and then finding families to adopt them, all of which is completely counterintuitive from a Balinese perspective. But she's doing it. She's turning things around. Linda's right hand in this venture is Ebony Owens, another Melbourne woman who is just given everything she's got and has done for about the last 6 or 7 years to the dogs of Bali. You can find out more and add support to Linda at barkforbalidogs.com or at barkforbalidogs.org. That's B-A-R-C, the number 4. barleydogs.org. All of this info will be on my website, michellelaurie.com. I apologise for the audio quality because I did record this on my phone in Bali, but I hope you'll hang in there. So settle in and enjoy the incredible twists and turns and lovely dogs of Linda Buller's life.
You've just had dengue fever for the third time.
I don't know why other people don't get it like I get it, but
they
don't seem to. I mean, everybody else I know has probably had it one time, about three times. It's just crazy. So and it's horrible. You don't want to be in your own skin. So you just got to get out of your own skin. For me, I just feel so uncomfortable and in a lot of pain. I usually scream the place down for a few hours.
Really?
Or maybe 3 days I screamed this time in the hospital. Yeah. So it's taken me like probably 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks to get over it this time. Mm. Like I was in the hospital for 7 days. And then that cost me $1,500 and I don't have any health insurance.
Right.
And I should have health insurance, working with dogs and animals and being, you know, ripped from limb to limb, you know, a lot of times, because we're working with wild dogs on the street and dogs that have been hurt and abused and they don't understand what human touch is and they're just scared shitless of people.
Is it strokes?
But, you know, the thing is about this place is I finally put myself on a wage about 3 years ago.
Okay.
So I put myself on a wage of $1,500 a month. But there's lots of times where Ebony and I both don't take a wage because we're scared there's not enough money in the bank for the things that we need to pay.
Yeah.
We've adopted out 60 dogs this month. It's been amazing. We've actually, people getting to know us. The Balinese are trusting that the dogs are really healthy and strong and vaccinated, sterilised, and they know that they're special dogs. We collar them and we take food up to them and we find out Balinese houses. And we try and get them onto one street so they can all talk to each other because they all know each other. So
yeah.
If we go up there with 20 dogs, we kind of like come back with, you know, 10 adopted. And those 10 know each other. So they'd be like in the Balinese houses for about 3 days on chains.
Yeah.
They get used to it. And then when they're let off, well, then they're walking around having conferences together, you know?
Yeah, great.
We're very enterprising, we are.
Yeah, you are.
And painting has kind of stopped for the meantime, but I still paint. Every month I've produced a painting, probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've got the sanctuary going up, that's another story, and that was on a documentary that's been made about us. It's called Stray.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Anderson made it, and it's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
But it explains all about, you know, how we had to get out of the first place that I found for the dogs. Had to get out of there. We had no money. We had no, and funny enough, money came in. And we found $120,000 to buy this hectare of land. You know, it's not just for dogs. We just finished a first open-air monkey sanctuary ever for macaques in the world, I believe.
Wow.
I believe. So it's just Ebony and I went, what do we have to close? We don't want to close them up. We don't want to have them in cages. Let's just try and make an open air. And I just said, well, what about we just make the walls really high? I mean, can you see a monkey jumping like 4 metres high? No, can't jump that high. No, no, no. Okay, so let's do that. So we left a couple of trees in the middle and we put these beautiful little kennels on stilts there. We've put ropes through. We've made it like a little creek, like a rocky like little creek. We've got water coming in all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just 2 days ago, we just took, we went up there and we released all the monkeys into the sanctuary.
Wow.
Yes. And we saw monkeys that have been catatonic their whole life, 15 years on chains, not being able to move. There's one little one called Rocky. She used to always have like something shiny like the top of that. She'd always have a mirror or something holding onto it. And it's very strange behaviour. And she was catatonic. She would just sit there. She wouldn't connect with any other animals and she would just sit there. We let her in. She immediately ran up the tree, like this high tree, discovered, looked out over the world, you know, came back down, played with the other monkeys, laid down. She let them all flee her and whatever they do, you know. So there's this incredible friendship and gang that's already, you know, family kind of orientated.
Why are they chained up? What's the...
Like people chain them up on the street. Like, it's just, I don't know, what is it?
Why would you do that?
No one tells me why. Well, why does a Balinese person go and buy a monkey from the market and then chain it up by the neck in the front of their house? I don't know.
Wow.
Is it so they look cute or something? I don't know.
Okay.
It was very prevalent in the old days, not so much now. But we have, like, Western people come here, like Aussies.
Mm.
Aussies are the worst.
There was a famous episode of that show... I can't remember, it's called something about Bali, I've never seen it on Australian TV, and there were these drunk girls scouring the streets, decided they had to buy a monkey. And then when they finally found a place to do it, though, they were so freaked out, and they realised it was just really sad, and they didn't do it. They were depressed by the whole thing, you know. But it struck a real chord around the country. A lot of people chatted about that episode.
Okay, so they went to the market in Denbasar.
I guess, yeah.
That's where they went. And would have. And monkeys are tied up by the neck, kept in tiny little cages, mothers are killed.
Oh, God.
It's a very, very cruel place to go. I don't go there. I avoid it because I'm already suffering enough sadness and stress every day, seeing dogs poisoned and eaten alive and all this shit, you know.
Yeah.
So I've got to watch how much stuff I get.
Oh, totally.
But there's a lot of Aussies that will go and buy monkeys. You've got to think about how long a monkey lives for. It lives for 30 years.
Yeah.
And you've got to think about when you take it away from its family. It doesn't have a family anymore, and no family's going to accept it. Has to be rehabilitated. There's nobody here in Bali that rehabilitates monkeys.
No.
So what happens to those monkeys? The stupid people that bought them, oh, isn't it fun? Let's go to a nightclub with this monkey on our shoulder for the next 2 weeks. And then after 2 weeks, what are we going to do with this baby, tiny baby monkey who needs his mummy?
They just let it go.
They probably just chuck it in the forest, and then they get torn to pieces. Because those other groups of monkeys are not going to accept it. So the best thing you can do is have that market closed down.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be doing what it's doing.
No.
There's people down there selling, rare species monkeys too. Keep them in dark boxes inside a room. And then when you ask for this kind of rare species monkey, they'll bring it out and show you and sell it to you for a lot of money. But it's against the law. I mean, it's against all human law. It's against all compassionate law, God's law, whatever the fuck you want to call it, you know, you don't do that.
No.
But they do here.
So how do you cope with being here? How do you not just say to yourself, I can't take it anymore, I've done my bit?
I say that every day.
Yeah.
But I've got something and I don't know what it is. I think it comes from my grandma or my Irish background. I'm just fucking diehard stubborn, I guess. I don't know what it is, but I laugh a lot, right?
Yeah, okay.
So I see ridiculous stuff. And I mean, you're either going to get yourself mad, which I do. I get really angry. Mm-hmm. And then I start laughing because you can't change it. What can you do? Live in a world where it's insane over here. There's no logic connected to a lot of the decisions that are made here. There's no logic connected to it. I mean, so you've got to have a laugh. I mean, how many houses you go into here, the steps go into nowhere.
Really?
Yeah, the steps go into nowhere. Like, they'll go up to the ceiling and then there's nothing. It's one of those ones in my gallery. I have a gallery here and the steps go into nowhere. So I've closed it up as a room and I've made it, you know, where I can put my paintings in there on these steps.
Yeah.
But what the fuck is that about? I mean, there's just no logic.
Yeah.
And it's like everything kind of
because it
like
seems
that.
Chaotic because I'm only ever here for 2 weeks at a time. But is it really chaotic?
Yeah, it's pretty chaotic.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it never used to be like that in Ubud because Ubud was like this nice, quiet little town when I first came here like 30 years ago.
Mm.
And that's why I fell in love with it 30 years ago. But now it's just like, it is time for me to get the hell out, really.
Really?
It really is, yeah. But I've got to find some other people to take over for me. Yeah, I've got to find someone who can. And in the meantime, I need to find probably a personal assistant to help us all, you know, do those little things like pay the electricity on those places and get the telephone fixed up and, you know, look into the laws that we could change and, you know, do research into what is possible, you know, what steps forward can we make, what positive changes can we make here. And, because years ago, dogs were allowed to run around the street. Yes, they suffered. Yes, they were neglected. Yes, they were. But they weren't, as far as I know, and I've been here for a long time, I never saw a prevalent level of abuse of the dogs, right?
Right.
But now there's full-on abuse of poisoning, beating. There's a war against dogs.
Yes. There's a government legislated program of poisoning, right?
Yeah.
These days. Uh-huh. They're trying to eradicate the street dogs.
Well, they're trying to eradicate rabies, but then what about all those dogs that we've sterilised and vaccinated and collared and given to people, and they've gone for a little walk down the road today to check out the offerings? Somebody yesterday put all this poison in the offerings. And what word would you use toward a religious person putting poison in the offering to God? I don't know. I don't have a word for that. But a lady was walking with her two Western dogs. They went up to the offerings, they ate it, and they fell down dead straight away.
Oh, my God.
So she watched her two dogs die. Yeah. So the thing is, you get the stage where you just feel like, oh, God, I can't do this any longer. I can't. My heart's breaking. And the other thing about it here is we'll have a broken heart. Then we'll have a dog that gets brought in that needs absolute immediate attention. So you go from that, oh, I've got a broken heart, I can't cope anymore, to action, let's help this dog, right?
Yeah.
Or let's help this monkey, or let's get out there, oh, this dog's been hit by a car, we've got to go and do that. So you kind of kept in the same sort of like this state of
vigilance and high alert
all the time. Yeah. Right. So then when I stop and I get to go to Australia for a couple of weeks, it's like I've got
post-traumatic stress
syndrome.
No, I think you probably have.
So I cry the whole bloody time. I mean, like, I sit there thinking, oh God, I'm so lucky, I come from Australia, I can go home and I can sit in someone's lounge room and I can just be here and I can just relax, or go to mum's farm and just be there with her, you know. I'm so lucky that I have that choice to do that, but I don't have that choice to go there very often. But when I do go there, I just think I'm so glad that I have that choice, that I can be in a quiet country where they're not abusing dogs in front of my face. But that's when I cry a lot, because as soon as I see a post, you know, on my Facebook about what Bark's doing, I'm like, oh, that poor little dog, oh, I'm going to go and save it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's just this, like, everything's so close to tears all the time when I'm back there.
So tell me about when you started this whole process.
Yeah, but you know, I was married to a Balinese man, and I just absolutely, totally, bloody adored him. And I was sick because I was drinking alcohol and I was, you know, smoking dope or whatever you do when you're younger.
Yeah, right.
And I met him when I was 34 over here, and I'm 60 now, so it's... But I met him, and then I got married to him. But I was sick in a lot of ways, because I was an addict of alcohol, but I was also an addict, a Mudday addict. I was addicted to him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a pain in the ass to be around, basically, because it was like... you know, come on, Monday, sit down there. Oh, come on, I'll get you something to eat. Oh, come on. He's like, leave me the fuck alone. I know how to do this. So I was really, you know, see what I'm like when I'm sober. I'm a fucking nutcase now. Imagine what I was like when I was drinking, you know, and like dancing on tables. And I got thrown out of every pub in Fitzroy, you know, like years ago, thrown out every pub. So, and I used to drag him to the pub, and he never drank. And why the fuck would you want to be in a pub, a mad pub like Biller's Arms in Fitzroy? I got thrown out of there. Yeah. You know, like, I was just a nutter. So, you know, that marriage broke down. But in the meantime, I'm an artist. Well, I've been painting my whole life. But in the meantime, I thought, I'm never going to make it as an artist. So I'm going to go to acupuncture college. So I took myself off to... I was a tram driver after the art school up in Bendigo. I took myself to Melbourne and just proceeded to get pissed and smoke dope all day and play with my friends. And then I got a job on the tram. So I became a bus tram driver and stuff. That was hilarious, because I'd sit up the front with my tranny radio, and I'd stop in the middle of the road outside my house, race inside, leave everybody on the tram. It was morning, like 8 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. I'd race inside, I'd dress my son, give him his bag, give him his lunch, and then send him off to school. I'd get back on the tram. By that time, there'd be another two trams behind me, full of irate, but not one of those customers would say a bloody thing. And then I'd say, all off. All off, we're late now, go turn the tram. Right, so I'd just go down the road, find the points, turn the tram around, go back up the depot. And yeah. I never once thought, I shouldn't be doing this. I never once thought, this is against the rule. I just thought, I'm the boss, this is my tram, I'll do what I like. And I've always had that attitude, and I don't know where that comes from, you know. It's like when Preston Council got me to do a mural on there, a big Peace Council mural, 1986. I was supposed to be going to acupuncture college. I forgot all about the acupuncture college. All I could see was a mural. So I spent 3 months doing the mural, and then went, oh, fuck, I was supposed to be going to acupuncture college, right? So I was late going to school. And I thought, this is, in a way, it's a defect of character. In another way, it's actually, I love the fact that I've got that thing where once I totally focus on something, then that's what happened here.
Yeah.
But you're saying, how did I start? So I was married to Mate, he got sick of me, you know, being who I was. I was pissed off at him because he wouldn't go to work enough and all this sort of stuff. So that marriage broke down. But I was completely heartbroken, and every single molecule in my body was screaming with grief and pain. And I actually have physical symptoms, you know. And I started getting to the booze more. And then I sold the house and I had $13,000 left, and I was supposed to pay that on a bill, a big bill. And I looked at the $13,000, and there's a big story between this and now, because what happened just after I split up with Mate, I went and bought a caravan, because this astrologist said to me, Linda, you've got two things in your stars. One of them is that you want to be completely free. The other one is that you love your domestic life, and you love to have your inner comforts. I thought, shit, I'll buy myself a caravan. And yep. Then I'll be able to take it anywhere I like, and then I'll have both those things, right? So I put broom or bust on the back of it, because I'd had this dream and this spirit had come to me in the dream saying, if you go to Broome, all your problems will be solved. So I thought, okay, so I'm going to go to Broome. So how do I get to Broome? I'll buy a caravan and then I'll have everything sorted. I'll go and buy a car now. I've got to go and buy a car. So I'm at the auctions and I went with a girlfriend, and I thought, I know I've got to buy a car that's got manual gears in it, because I've got to pull that caravan. So I went there and I saw a nice blue car. She said, well, that's a great colour, that car. I went, fuck it, I'm going to buy that. Bought that car. It was an automatic.
Oh.
So within like, 300 mile of going to Broome out of Melbourne, it started pissing oil out of the thing. It was overheated. That was a joke. I'm standing on the veranda at this lady's place because I'd got the van to a place. I got myself some sort of disease or some horrible flu, and I couldn't. And this lady said, come park it at my house. Park the van there. Had run out of money almost, and that was in Bendigo. That was not in Bendigo. That was in Ballarat, outside Ballarat.
And you're alone?
I was alone. I was having to pull a caravan and put it on the, you know, those leveler things. And Standing out the backyard that day, and she was going to buy my massage service, because I haven't told you that I had a massage service I'd set up in Australia, in Melbourne, when I was with Mate, because I was studying acupuncture, and I set up a massage. And I had all the famous people. I was doing Nina Simone and Ben Kingsley and, you know, Lou Reed and all the big names. I was the first massage service in Melbourne, you know. Anyway, I thought, I'll sell it to her, because I was too heartbroken. I'd be massaging and I start crying, you know. I thought, oh, fuck, I'm over it, you know. Can't do this.
Yeah.
So I said to her, I'll park my van out in front of your house. You're a masseur. Maybe you'll buy my business in Melbourne. She goes, okay. Anyway, she must have been one of those mad people or something. The next morning she came and she goes, get rid of the van. I don't want it in my driveway.
Oh, no.
I said, but I won't be able to pull it back to Melbourne. I said, because the fucking engines, it's an automatic. Don't worry about it. It's all downhill, she goes. I went, oh, shit, it might be too. But I'm standing out in the, and I had one last piece of bread, and I had one last tomato, put the tomato in the toast. And I thought, I'm just going to have a coffee and I'll have this. And I'm just about to take a mouthful of this sandwich. And this bloody magpie flew down from up in the tree and swiped the tomato from inside the bread and took off. And I thought, this is my life. Well, this is my life. Have to change things. So I went and got a ticket. I got that caravan back to my mother's place. My mother said, I don't like you here. You're a pain in the ass. I went, okay, fine. I was suicidal. I thought, okay, I've got $13,000. I'm going to go to Bali. Because, you know, I'd fallen in love with Bali a long time ago. Artist.
Yep.
I always had a dream. I envisaged that I would be in Bali painting and spitting at people, because I don't like people very much. I just get them away from me. I'll spit at them, and I'll have a studio up in the mountain somewhere, and I'll paint. And I'll be famous because all the paintings will be amazing.
Yeah.
Right? So I had that, envisaged that. And I thought, well, I've got to get on with my life. I'm either going to kill myself now, which I was very close to doing, or I'm going to go to Bali. So I went to Bali, and I got clean. I came to Bali and I was sitting up in the bar going, oh, I'm an acupuncturist and you want to fucking, you know, healthy, you want to come and get healthy, come see me, oh, fucking the best mate, fuck, you know. And everyone had an issue with that and I couldn't work out what it was. And then one day, kind of light went on, you know, and I was always crying because this had hurt me when I was a little girl and, you know, life was just fucked. You know, and I was just moaning and whinging and whining. Two glasses of wine, I was crying drunk, you know. Mm. So anyway, I found a meeting and I went to a 12-step program and got myself cleaned up. Mm. And then I started, I got a little house, $700 for the year. And well, I hunted everywhere because I only had that 13 grand. I'd spent four on my son because he'd been on, you know, had his own problems and he was porn and shit and I had to get all that stuff out for him. So then I had about 10 grand. And then I thought, oh, you can pay for transport, that's expensive. So I bought a motorbike and some nice Balinese person, friend of a friend who was vouched for, bought it for me, put it in his name, then I paid it off and I still have that motorbike. Bought that in 1997, that was the bike I drove in on today.
Yeah.
Still have that, love that motorbike. It drives really fast when you want it to go. So anyway, so it saved all that. So I started going to meetings all around the island. I'd take my bike and drive on my bike down at Kuta and everywhere. But as I drove, I would see puppies that had been thrown out in the street or their heads were, like, just about severed and their legs were severed and they were dragging their bodies around. I couldn't stand it and I couldn't paint while I saw that sadness. And so I just thought, oh, I'll fucking give up. I'm going to have to do something about it. And the first time I came here and I met Made, I saw a dog in Nusa Dua. And I'll never forget it. I was walking in the street in Nusa Dua. It was a hot, stinking hot day. And there was this skinny, poor, depleted, abused, just abandoned, neglected, poor little thing walking the street. And half his skull had been smashed off. So you could see his brain.
Oh, my God.
And he was just staggering the street. And I said to the boyfriend, Made, what about that poor dog? Is there a vet or is there... And he goes, what are you talking about? And he said, ah, ha, ha, so funny, he forgot to put his helmet on.
Oh.
And I married that guy, you know. Now, what could I have loved about him? I was just in some sort of addictive sex state. That's what happened to me. But if anybody was to speak to me about an animal suffering like that, I'd just walk the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Why would I want to have anything to do with somebody that spoke like that to you? Yeah. But that was the, and it still is in a lot of ways. That's a consciousness about animals here. Is like. The fucking animal, what the fuck are they? They're just there to be used because, you know, humans here are born, they're higher than any animal. And so the humans that are born here, they're like, they're halus, they're higher life form, right?
Yeah.
Higher life form. So all the animals below, we humans here are there to be used, hit, abused, eaten, whatever. The one thing I'm very grateful for is being brought up in an Australian society where I've been given that ability to have time on my own to grow into the sort of person I wanted to be, which is a person who can love animals and share with them. And we have that in Western society. We're given that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we can bitch and whinge and whine and everything in a Western society about everything in our lives, but you come and live here and you see what these people have. They have nothing. A lot of people here have nothing, and then they don't have even the ability to love an animal. So to me, loving an animal is being closer to whatever made them, like a higher power. Yeah.
But you're right, we have that luxury, don't we?
It's a real luxury.
To live in a developed nation where we have the time and the energy and the... space to sit down and love an animal.
And sit down and watch a telly and sit down and be out in the street and not be looking at suffering every couple of minutes, you know, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, how old are you now?
64.
64.
Scorpio.
And
my
number kids are one. Scorpios.
Yeah.
And you're thinking seriously that you would like to retire...
Well, you know what? I'll always have my finger in this pie somehow because I started it and I love it and I love seeing the dogs well. But, you know, the loveliest thing that would satisfy me is to see that sanctuary is finished and working. There's money coming in for Bark. you know, that there's someone to oversee it as well as I would, you know.
So what is that job, realistically? What, you know, if you were to describe your job...
You know
job...
what, I've learned how to coordinate. I've learned how to problem shoot, you know, like, what's the
word? Yeah, problem solve, yeah.
Problem solve. I've learned how to deal with the government. I've learned how to talk to a Balinese authority. I've learned how to make sure that my staff love those animals, not just treat them like, you know, they learn, they have to be taught, and they have to be pulled up. You pick a dog up by a leg, or you pick a dog up by the back of his neck, or you don't pick a dog up the right way. Stop.
I was wondering that when I saw your local staff, I thought, are they... Do some people in Bali love animals the way we do, or have you taught them?
They have had to learn. I mean, Made, my favourite, is one of my most lovely, loyal boys that have been with me from the very beginning. He came in, he didn't like dogs.
Wow.
He now allows his child to sleep with his dog, and, you know, and he encourages...
Wow.
And he is also an amazing human, is Made. He's in the documentary, you'll see him, but... He also said on the documentary, I was really worried and scared of Ibu Linda, he said, because she was so class, so aggressive about what she wanted us to be. And he said, I understand that, he said, because she wanted us to care for the animals, and because she loves them so much, she wants it all right for them. So when a dog comes in, individually has to be loved. It has to be given a blanket. It has to be given food. It has to be given whatever we have that we can give, we give. So in a lot of instances now, though, there's so many dogs coming in, and there's no other place here that will take dogs in like we do, right? We are overloaded a lot of the time. We don't have enough cages. We don't have enough blankets. We don't have enough good food. We don't have enough funding to buy that stuff. But, you know, I've worked out food. It's taken me, like, years to work out. How do I feed a dog where it's not going to cost too much? And we've had 400 dogs up till now, right?
Wow. At once.
At once.
Yeah.
At once. And we have them cycling like that.
Yeah.
So... I've worked out that we have rice, potato, egg, chicken. We pick up all these bones from this place up the road, and we grind them all up, and we put that in the food as well. Pumpkin and sweet potato. And as far as I'm concerned, that is a very good diet for the dog. A lot of the times I go, oh, what the fuck is this? Now, they would really like to have some sambal matar in there,
yeah.
or something that smells like the street in
yeah.
there, because they're street dogs. They find their own food. But it sustains them.
Yeah.
And all our dogs are fat.
Yeah, yeah.
And healthy. So.
But what's the day-to-day of your job?
Day-to-day for my job is, I don't know, it's everything. For me, I oversee everything, okay? So,
yeah. So how many dogs have you got at the moment?
250.
Yeah. So you have to make sure that they're fed and...
Well, I don't. I just assume that my staff are doing that.
Right.
And if there's any trouble, then they'll tell me and then I'll try and fix that.
Okay.
So up on the land, for example, I have a driver who takes the food. It gets cooked every night. He takes it up there. He stands there because I thought that the food was missing and dogs were getting skinny. So I've asked this driver, his other job is to go up there and watch them feed every single dog, to make sure every single dog is getting their amount of food.
What do you think was happening?
Well, maybe they were giving it to their pigs.
Right, okay.
But anything that you do here, you have to double check to make sure it's not being, snuck away somehow.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing here, is that you have to really have your eyes open about what's being taken, what's being... embezzled, what's being, you know, even little notices, you know, from the laundry, the prices will get changed, you know, it's just, you just got to be aware.
Is that overall, do you think, or is it?
Yeah, okay. No, it's overall.
Because you're also trying to achieve something that's not really highly regarded in Bali, is it? Protection of, whereas in Australia, you know, we do have a lot of respect for people who care for animals.
People are bending over backwards to help you,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, but here it's sort of a, it must seem like very strange.
We're like virus. We're like a virus that the government doesn't want around. So, because they want to murder, they want to get rid of all the dogs, and we're trying to say, please, please, please don't do that, please, let's have some respect for the God's creatures, you know, and let's have some respect for each other. And a lot of people say to me, Linda, why are you spending your time doing this? Why don't you look after kids?
Yeah.
And I go, well, we are looking after kids, because what we do is we get open their hearts to love an animal.
Yeah.
If I didn't have Clancy when I was a little girl, I didn't have Bob, I'd be a completely different person. And I would be a person who didn't have this heartfelt thing that I love having.
Yeah.
And when I help a dog, and that's what I would expect our manager to be, a person who would bend over backwards for any animal that comes in.
Mm.
And we work 24 hours a day.
Mm.
So, I mean, I get out of bed, I'm supposed to be doing stuff in my 12-step program, which is, you know, just doing something for myself. A lot of times I don't do that. I don't pray, I don't give myself up to God. But I do know I have a higher power, and every time I have a difficult situation, I will give it to God. Yeah. I will give it. So let it go and let something else deal with it. And it always gets dealt with.
Yeah.
So important for me is to have somebody that doesn't have an ego. You can't be walking around here with an ego.
No.
Somebody who is up first thing in the morning, checking the emails, checking the rescues, checking all the staff, where they all are.
Yeah, you need a person like you. You need a person who is prepared to give everything to these dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no fooling. No, like, you know, no Bali lifestyle. No coming here to surf or to...
That's it.
Yeah.
There's no drinking.
No.
There's no drugs. There's no... Yeah. But, I mean, it's, you know, helping animals is a lifestyle. And it's,
yes.
And it's a very giving one. You get so much back, you know, like... You see a dog stand up when he, like that little boy you saw in the clinic before, like he came in, they'd thrown him outside because they had so many dogs they didn't know what to do. So they put him outside on a blanket on the veranda and he was having to just be there. And I came in and said, what's this dog doing here? He can't be here.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, he bites and everything. He doesn't bite anymore. That was 4 days ago.
Wow.
And he's picked his legs up and he started walking now because we've been loving each other for 3-4 days.
Yeah, right.
Cuddling and talking and... And I give him, and every time he sees me now, he's just about beside himself. So, and that's, he can change. You can change the health of a dog by giving them that extra.
Well, love. Even in Australia, a dog that was paralysed, would be put down.
That's right.
I've never seen anything like that in my life.
We've healed a lot of dogs that were paralysed.
I didn't know a dog could do that. Could walk around on its front feet, holding up its back feet.
Oh, yeah.
It was a real eye opener for me.
They even play ball.
It's amazing. Yeah.
So, every dog deserves a chance. Like, every human deserves a chance.
It does. I think, you know, if everyone did their bit, just that's all. If everyone just did a bit, what a different world would be. Because...
That was Linda Buller from the Bali Dog Refuge. BaliDogRefuge.com is where you can find more info about her and get involved and offer her some support. I have to thank a Twitter friend, @BarkingMadGC is their name and Twitter handle. That person, lady or man, nominated Linda as a great person to chat to while I was in Bali for this podcast. So I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. If you have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them. There's a contact form on my website, michellelaurie.com. We have some more from Bali coming up soon. Thank you for downloading this one. Please download them all. And if you feel so inclined, take yourself off to iTunes and leave us a nice review. If you hated the podcast, just go quietly on your way and don't tell anyone. That would be great. Bye. Yeah.